This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Martin Amis, one of England's most popular and acclaimed writers, has written a new satirical novel about a failed novelist consumed with jealousy over his oldest friend's literary success. The failed novelist, Richard Tull, thinks of his books as modernist genius novels, but even his editors find them unreadable. In fact, most of them are unpublishable. The only way Tull can think of to make his life tolerable again is to ruin the life of his successful friend, Gwyn Barry. In an ironic twist, Martin Amis's success has left him in the center of controversy, mostly surrounding his $800,000 book advance. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says she hopes Amis is laughing all the way to the bank. After all, he worked 5 years to create a savagely funny novel that also makes readers think seriously about art and immortality. I asked Martin Amis to compare the writing styles of the two main characters in his new novel.
Richard is what one might call a marooned modernist. He follows the path blazed by Joyce. This was a time when we all seemed to like difficult novels. We craved difficulty. Nothing could ever be good unless it was very difficult. It stretched you till you twanged, you know, that was the idea. Whereas in the 19th century, and I think we've reverted to this now, most novelists would say that the art is very much to do with pleasing the reader, not with stretching the reader. Still, this is pleasing the reader is not what we're meant to think when we contemplate the work of Gwyn Barry. All Gwyn does really is not offend the reader. He writes novels that might have been, you know, patched together to fit an age of political euphemism. You know, everyone is, there's almost a sort of quota system in his fiction. Every race is represented. There are 6 women, 6 men. Everyone has a non-disfiguring disease so that no one need feel any worse or better than anyone else. It's a kind of even-handed positive discrimination kind of fiction that he writes, and of course is wildly successful in this climate.
There's so much in your new novel about literary jealousy. Actually, let me read a couple of lines. There's a part where Richard Tull is reading reviews of his rival Gwyn Barry's new novel, and Tull thinks, "The reviews, while hardly the pyrotechnic display of sarcasm and contempt for which Richard hoped, had nonetheless been laudably condescending and unanimous and brief. With any luck, Gwyn was finished." Do you think that jealousy comes with the territory when you're a writer? Do you think most writers wish their rivals ill?
I think that's exactly right. I think any writer who tells you different is either putting you on or isn't a serious writer deep down. You know, Gore Vidal has said, it's not enough to succeed, others must fail. And every time something nice happens to a contemporary of mine, Gore Vidal has said, I die a little. I think I put it loosely or poetically when I say that writers have to hate each other or have to be, you know, invidious with regard to one another, because they're competing for something there's only one of, which is the universal. You want everyone to be reading you and not wasting their time reading other people. And that's, I've just taken this to an extreme, as I tend to do in my work.
So do bad reviews of others make you feel good?
They put a little spring in my step, but not, you know, not for long. I think, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote this book and what over or under qualifies me to write about writing is that I was born into a house where there already was a writer, my father. And writing for me is completely unexotic, because nothing is less exotic than what you see your father doing every day. So I get these little impulses, these vanities, these vicious stabs, and I recognize them and even play with them and run with them for a bit. But they don't actually, you know, they don't really engage me, exercise me. I get a little, you know, high when I see someone getting a bad review and feel a little bit depressed when I see someone getting praised.
Let me get to some of the controversy surrounding your book deal, which has been written about at least as much as the book itself has been. The big story in the press about your book is that you had apparently asked for £500,000 as an advance, which is the equivalent of about $800,000, and that you left your former agent for a new agent, and that agent was the wife of a good friend, the novelist Julian Barnes. She's the one who you left. Let me ask you why you set a fee and asked for that much. A lot of people apparently thought that it was really unseemly for a serious novelist to ask for that big in advance.
Well, I ask you to imagine how weary I am of this whole subject, but to begin with, I didn't demand or stick at this sum. I just suggested it as an opening bid. Where are we? I mean, as you describe this whole controversy, you fail to make it sound very sexy or scandalous to me. That what happened was, I changed agents and in midstream, and the agent is married to a friend of mine, who's a novelist. But I haven't chopped anyone up and put them underneath my kitchen floorboards. Does this, in fact, sound to you like a story?
I'm not saying I thought it was the most incredibly amazing revelatory thing I'd heard, but I know it's been covered a lot.
Well, I know, but I think the only way of looking at this and staying sane is that you take it as a story about England rather than a story about me, because the bare bones of the case, don't sound very headline grabbing in American terms, do they?
My guest is Martin Amis, and he's written a new novel called The Information. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Martin Amis. His new novel is called The Information. I want to ask you a little bit about the literary profile and how writers' professional and private lives are dealt with in those profiles. First of all, this figures into your novel, The Information, because the unsuccessful writer is following around the successful writer so he can write a profile of him. And you've both profiled a lot of writers in your own literary career, and you've been the subject of many profiles. In recent profiles, those profiles have been going into your private life and the fact that you left your wife and are with somebody else now, and it's been going into changing the agents and the amount of money you got for your advance and this and that. Do you feel that there's a line that should be drawn in a literary profile between what's personal and what's public? Do you have your own kind of sense of personal ethics?
I certainly have a code, and if a writer I'm profiling says, I don't want you to say anything about this, then I won't. But there's nothing is off the record anymore. I find that, my father also divorced my mother when I was 12, and he was in the papers a good deal. And as I remember, all you had to deal with in those days from the press was a great deal of hypocrisy. Now that's changed, because there's no need for hypocrisy anymore, because everyone's proud of being an unscrupulous bastard. And it's more a kind of manic scurrility now is what you get, where people will just slap anything onto the page, print it, and sit back giggling and hugging themselves with how irresponsible they've been. The impulses you're facing, which are to do with ripping down people that you've exalted, etc., puncturing the vanity and affectation of artistic types, you're always having to deal with that, and jealousy and envy. But the language, the tone changes with time, and it's become, I can tell you, it's become very, very much coarser. I think more in England than here, funnily enough.
More in England than here?
Yeah.
I have to agree with you that things have really gone overboard in the investigation of people's private lives, of public people's private lives. I don't mean elected officials, but, writers and actors and so on. Mm. And as an interviewer myself, I know that I'm kind of a party to some of that, but I always feel like What I'm trying to do is make connections between somebody's life and the work that they've produced that interests us so much. What happened in the life that led to this interesting work?
But I disagree. Yeah, I don't think there is any connection.
Well, that's what I wanted to know from you. Like, where do you think the legitimate connections lie? Like, when you're profiling somebody, where do you think the legitimate connections lie between a person's life and their art?
Well, I think it's a journalistic convention to make these connections. Mm-hmm. I think they're in fact deeply mysterious. When I interviewed Saul Bellow, I quoted something he'd written, which he said, "You know, why interview me? It's all in the books." Updike has said it too. It is kind of all in the books, somewhere in the books, and you get a much more complicated sense of that something in the books. But we live in a culture where, you know, it's much more fun and much easier to get a handle on a personality, quote unquote, than on a corpus of work. But if you look at, you know, look back in literature and read literary biographies, and you know, halfway through your second one, you'll realize that there, in fact, is no useful connection between the life and the work, and there's certainly no moral connection. You know, writers, on the whole, lead pretty messy lives. This doesn't affect the work. The work is still there. If a writer's life did, by its laxity or its messiness, contaminate the work, then we wouldn't have any literature. It would all have to go.
It's funny you should mention literary biography, because one of the things the main character does in your book is review literary biographies, but they're really kind of second-rate biographies about second-rate writers.
Mm.
Duds about duds.
Yeah.
Is, I think, what he
calls
it.
Duds on duds.
Yeah. So have you been thinking about this a lot? You know, what kind of literary biography makes sense?
I've never thought any of it made sense. And the first literary biography I ever reviewed, I was 23 or 4 at the time, and I said, well, 21, I said that my opening sentence was, the literary biography is a dead genre. It makes false connections between the work and the life. It imputes to the author a kind of a grand design, you know, a sort of plan. And every writer knows that you never plan anything. You know, you just write the next thing that is given you to write, and that's the end of it. It promotes various fallacies about how writing is done, that it's in response to various events and situations, and it isn't. I think you would write more or less what you were going to write no matter what happened to you in your life. I'm sort of romantically inclined to make a complete distinction between the life and the work.
What makes you then want to sometimes profile other writers?
Well, you want to meet them. Reading someone is like meeting them. When you finished a book you love, don't you find you have an impulse to ring them up?
Oh, sure, but I think that's what lies behind why people want to read profiles, too, is that if you've fallen in love with somebody's work,
you want
to know,
more.
Like, well, who is this person?
Yeah.
And you want to be in their presence somehow, and you want to find out more. You're just, like, really curious because you like the work so much.
That's right. But idle and vulgar curiosity is all that it is, really. And to take it further, really, you should read more of their books. But we live in a kind of sort of personalized culture. You know, this is why people love signed copies. This is why people like to meet the author. You want a piece of it. And that is why, you know, in some cases, writers can stir up a kind of a tabloid fever temporarily, because, they either love you or think they own you or want to kill you. I mean, it does get violent, because reading is a very intimate activity, and you really are getting close to a writer when you read him, and it's our literal mindedness, perhaps, that makes us want to, you know, go and have a drink with him and sit in his lap.
The successful novelist in your novel, The Information, one of his hobbies is imagining how the authorized biography of him is going to read years from now when it's written. Why did you have him imagining that?
Because I do get these stabs of outrageous conceit and vanity, and I do run with them and see where they lead. And I look for the comedy in them, and I just thought, you know, for perhaps one second of one day, I thought that to myself. Well, I just realized, I thought, I probably am going to have my biography written. And then as I went to get a cup of coffee, I had in my head, you know, often he would go in mid-morning and make a cup of coffee. He preferred Colombian and medium roast, etc. And I thought this is insane and hideous. But then I sort of ran with it for a bit and thought, no, this is very funny and it'll be perfect for my vain novelist character.
Martin Amis, his new novel is called The Information. This is Fresh Air.